David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 346. I'm your host, AIM Sleeper Agent Steve Raker, keeping my vectors straight from the comic book bunker, and with me soon will be Andrew the LA Rabbit and WWX Kevin to discuss some recent reads. Then Gary Arkell returns to the show to cover the post-Byrne, Bill Mantlo-penned era of Alpha Flight with issues 29 to 50 of their first series. You can find episodes of Marvel Noise, new and old, on marvelnoise.com, as well as wherever fine podcasts are hosted. New episodes are announced and images are posted over on our Twitter and Facebook pages, which are also good places to say hi and let us know how we're doing. How are you doing? Marvel Noise is happily part of Derek Howard's Deliberate Noise Network, which offers a plethora of other noise for you to discover. And before I get Andrew and Kevin on, let me again tout the hopefully still coming 2020 Baltimore Comic Con at the Baltimore Convention Center in the Inner Harbor Zone of Baltimore this coming October 23rd, 24th, and 25th. Hey, with those dates, there's still a chance, right? One of the best cons this side of the Mississippi, one not to be missed, especially if you're a comic book lover and an art lover. Find out more at BaltimoreComicCon.com. Now let's see if I can calibrate this doohickey thingamajiggy and call forth the guys. All right, Andrew, Kevin, I pulled you in as hoped. What's going on, guys?
Hey, Super Steve. How's tricks?
Not for kids.
What have you guys been reading? I've been catching up on a lot of things old and new.
Only new all the time.
Really? You've been catching up on a lot of the newish stuff that had been piling up?
Yeah, some stuff that you had covered that I wasn't up to date on.
Like what?
Like Venom. I was only partway through the Absolute Carnage. That's what it was. Almost said Maximum Carnage, and I'm like, wait, that doesn't sound right. I mean, it was a fine event, I guess. You like when I start like that.
Because I'm like, all right, are you done? Is that all we're going to get out of Kevin? Or am I going to, you know, how do I pull this out? You know, I feel like your analyst where I'm like, well, so tell me how it made you feel. Did you read all the way up to the first part of the Venom Island thing that's going on now, or just the event?
No, I'm up to, yeah, I think it's part four of Venom Island. It's funny because it's one issue short of, like, the finale.
Right.
So that's just kind of like, awkward stopping point when you're just plowing right ahead, right?
Tough time to pause, for sure.
Yeah, it's just... I mean, it won't be as big of a pause as other people had, so I guess that's...
The Venom stuff had such a... I mean, it was building to so many... All these, like, little peaks that were really crescendos, you know? And one event after another or a big happening, and it all seems to be building towards somewhere. And somehow, I think even with the Absolute Carnage thing happening, they've kept up the momentum rather well, yeah, I think.
Yeah, I guess I would compare it to, like, maybe, like, this might sound weird. These are the first two things I thought about, though. It's like Remender was building to something with, like, Uncanny X-Force, or, like, Hickman was building to things on his, like, Avengers, like, you get to Infinity, but Infinity was only, like a stopping point along the way.
Sure.
So, yeah, it seems... I think we all... Well, pretty much. I don't know, like, if the run would end once you finally get to Null, but that seems to be, like, the end point since almost the beginning. And there's kind of a fake out it's one of these issues where, oh no, he's already on Earth. And I'm just like, yeah, well, that'd be hilarious if you just do all that setup and then just totally savage your story. Just like, it's already happening. We missed the whole beginning.
They've managed.
Like, I would almost respect that in a weird way, but it also would be like a waste. Because it seems like the whole Venom Island is just like a series of fake outs and weird things going on.
But there had
not
been
a whole lot of content necessarily, but
there had been that Carnage Island. So I think this is kind of the yin to that yang, or yang to that yin.
It's definitely more of a character focused, like breather type of thing. And it goes back to that island that I know very well, because might be my first Venom story that I read. If not, it was pretty close. Where I always found it hilarious that Venom and Spider-Man are fighting on the island before Amazing 350, and then he just tricks them into thinking, he's just like, oh yeah, a piece of the Spider-Man costume is on the skeleton. Oh, that must mean that he's dead or whatever. And then, of course, later on when, you know, Carnage comes about, then Spider-Man ends up having to go back to the island. And then Venom, like, hey, I need your help. I thought you were dead.
Yeah. I mean, the first part of that was such a great way to set it up, where Venom could be taken off the board for as long as they wanted to, and it was easy to figure out how he was going to come back. He's just on that island, not knowing, you know, that Spider-Man's still alive. It's the old, there's still a Korean guy and an American fighting in the woods who doesn't know the war's over kind of a thing, you know?
And this is the funny thing is, so many stories like that, you just read them, and they either have, like, one idea or 1,000 ideas, and there's always something there. But you're just like, that was a story. You didn't really think any more about it. Like, why are there skeletons on this island? What was this island used for before? Like, you never really gave it much thought, right? So this whole story is, like, giving you that background. Like, what is going on there? What is there? What happened? Which is fine.
I like that in such a high-profile title. Like you said, this is a real character piece. They managed to stick with the whole story being sticking with the character and the relationship with the son and all that stuff. Plus, they keep it square in the middle of the Marvel Universe by having all the superhero contact, right? And then they're having all of these build-ups, these mini-events, these false summits, like you said, but that are, you know, for most titles, it's as much attention as they would get, you know, in a 5-year span by editorial. And they've managed to maintain the horror tone, I think, pretty well through the whole book. I've been impressed. This has been Cates' best work for Marvel.
And the guys
before him, they didn't do too bad either. They've really handled Venom very well, I think, as far as keeping me interested in a character that I don't really care to necessarily read about.
Well, it's weird because I was like super fan. Then at some point I just totally dropped off. And then I was just totally not interested. And then you get a few good stories and I'm like, yeah, obviously there's some connection. Like, there are some things where you were like into as a kid and you're just like that and the connection was just totally severed, right? So I don't think the Venom one was. I would say maybe more Carnage. Like, I was a big Carnage guy, and I don't think I'll just ever be as big as a Carnage. Well, the thing is, as we've seen with the Thunderbolts things, I look at like past Kevin, and then I see some of his writings, and then he's like best villain and whatever was written down, and I'm just like. Like, that's not my memory of... I remember liking him, but I don't remember liking him, like, super a lot. But that I think part of that is over the years of, like, everyone just becomes a serial killer or whatever. Like, obviously it wasn't overused, and I hadn't read a lot of stories, so that was... And it was connected to Venom, so I'm sure that's what the Carnage angle came in. So yeah, I came back to Venom, and yeah, he's been treated pretty well. Like he's I wouldn't say an A-lister, but he's definitely been given a lot of time, a lot of attention.
I would say Venom's pretty A-lister type. I mean, at this point, he's had numerous series, headlined his own, been, you know, run, had his own event. Like, that's A-list.
He is now.
I think it would have made a difference for me, instead of doing 100 miniseries in the 90s, if they would have just gave him an ongoing. Like, I think I would have stuck with an ongoing.
Yeah, I don't know.
It helps you to have a movie, a big successful movie, too. So that brings you out. And it wasn't just like the Eddie's just goofing around with the Venom symbiote on an island too. Like they did have another part of the story where Dylan is there, his I guess son so far, right now, until they change it maybe.
Yeah.
Is sort of doing his whole thing and I guess furthering the long term plot of the series. Which is getting weird.
Weird is okay.
Yeah, and I can't complain about Bagley. Like, you know, we've had a lot of we might have complained about certain stylistic things that he does, but
yeah.
He's drawing the same way he drew like in the 90s is now, like very consistent.
Yeah, I was just gonna say it's like I'm used to his Venom, right? I mean,
yeah,
he's also lots of fun. I mean, I've picked up books just because he's the artist. I think that it'd be, yeah, I don't have any. I mean, I goof on him, but I still think it's fun. It's good comic booking.
It's good storytelling. Like, yeah. I can't fault that.
What have you been reading, Andrew?
Well, I've been going back to the future. If the future is the mid-90s. As you boys know, I've took a hiatus from comics, so sometimes I go fill in the gaps.
I think you really enjoy filling in the gaps, though. Like I enjoy some 90s stuff, but you just go hog wild, just right in there. You find, like, some deep crevice somewhere, and you're there.
Well, I try and think about my fellow podcasters and get a little something for everybody, because I know the 90s are kind of your jam, Kevin. So I'm like, well, this is Kevin's era and Kevin's character. And then I know Steve, rightly, likes a little Tom Palmer, as does everyone. So that gives Steve a little bit intro into this. But I'm not that familiar with a lot of the other ones. But I was on the Marvel Unlimited and found my way to Avengers Unplugged number 5.
How did you find your way there?
Wow. I was looking for mid-90s Avengers.
Okay.
And because, like I said, I know you like the Avengers, and this has, you know, your Captain Marvel, Kevin, in it, and my Captain Marvel, yeah, which was becomes Photon, and they face off against each other here. Now, I'm not super familiar with Glenn Herdling, and then also it's M.C. Wyman on pencils, Sandu Floria, and Tom Palmer on inks. But I know Steve, and everyone likes Tom Palmer, so that gives us all something. Now, do you gentlemen remember the 1996 Avengers and Captain Marvel's kid, Genius?
Genius?
Genius? Yes, yeah. Yes, I do. I don't remember that book that well, though.
So,
because it had a weird publication schedule, from what I remember.
The Unplugged thing was part of that publishing initiative to have Dollar Comics again.
Yes.
Because, yeah. And so there was Fantastic Four Unplugged, Avengers Unplugged. There might have been some other Unplugged. And there was, you know, they were trying to get books out. And so you weren't getting the top tier creative teams necessarily. It was almost like an anthology series. You know, things don't carry over from issue to issue necessarily. But there's some gems in there.
There are. This one is one. Well, let me take... Okay, at this point, the new Cap... Now, this is not a character... I know you guys know this one really well. But for me, Captain Marvel was really actually Monica Rambeau, mostly. I mean, I read The Death of Captain Marvel. But as a kid, I hadn't read a lot of the original Captain Marvel comics. They just didn't really interest me. I was never a Rick Jones guy. I really loved the death of Captain Marvel, but that also was like, I felt like that was the best of Captain Marvel, and
yes.
I didn't need to mess around with like why, you know, sometimes you get that great story and you're like, you know what, that was a great take on the character. I'm good. You know, I'll catch it here. So when Monica came by, I really liked the character. It was fun. It was a fun Avengers lineup. But this guy, the design, it's, he's not, his outfit has like a jacket built into it. So it's awesome because you get the great 90s jackets and you still have the superhero outfit.
Great 90s jackets.
And it's the old school Captain Marvel outfit where it's the mask with the tops open, so his hair. So he has a short on top, but he has a ponytail, no lie, that's like 4 or 5 feet long.
It's like Batman's cape. Like
Legacy?
Yeah, it's kind of something. And then this is also the 90s, so like everyone is super ripped. But
well, it's MC like, Wyman with Floria Inc., so yeah.
So I enjoy, you know, because another character I liked always a lot was Star Fox, but I love like the ultra ripped Star Fox. Like,
oh, geez.
He's been hitting the gym, but it starts out anyways with my Captain Marvel, who has been captured by the controller, and they do a very menacing controller who is smoking, by the way. So that should let you know who the editor in chief was at this time.
I don't know if I've ever seen the controller smoke.
Yeah, he's got a cigar, and he's proving the control disc works. And under this iteration of the controller, the discs work, but you're still conscious underneath it. But you can't stop. So he sends our Captain Marvel to go after Genius Vell, who is partying with Star Fox. But so it's got like a cosmic angle. I know you like Cosmic Steve.
I do.
So they race up. She takes out Star Fox. She's dressed in an evening gown. And it seems kind of, I guess she wants to isolate him before she attacks him. But it seemed a little labored. I don't want to say it was an excuse just to put her in an evening gown. But it seemed a little like they wanted a little bit of cheesecake. Unnecessary ruse. What I did enjoy was, in her thoughts, she's fighting this, so she has to fight him hard and bring him back to the control. But she's doing it in a that clever way where you it's like a genie kind of. You're following the letter of the law, but not the spirit. So they have the battle, and every time she's trying to reveal who she really is, you know, that it's not her doing it on purpose. And so she knocks him out and takes him to Earth, where they continue to fight. And at that point, there is a, you know, her data core will allow me to do anything to win this battle. Does that include summoning help on a pirated radio frequency? Captain Marvel has the ability to generate all types of radiation and frequencies. So she sends a blast to the Avengers. And let me tell you something. The Vision has been hitting the gym like nobody's business.
Does he need to hit the gym?
He is yoked like, he looks like old school Drax the Destroyer, kind of ripped. So we're going to get an Avengers lineup I'm not as familiar with. That's a Vision and Deathcry.
Oh, wow.
So not my Avengers per se, but an Avengers team. I mean, I know obviously Vision a long time. Now Deathcry shows up. She sees them fighting, and she's going to go against the Kree. So she must know that he's Kree because he doesn't have the blue skin or any of that stuff. But I guess he's famous enough that she would know. So they team up. So it's 3-on-1. But, you know, over the course of it, they're able to stop. In one attack, Monica does an X-ray attack, and that allows the Vision to see the controller disc. So he pops the controller disc out, and now it's going to be all 5 of them going to go visit the controller. It's literally like 2 panels worth of work of him. But then it turns out that the controller is being controlled.
What? Never heard a million years.
Twist.
And so the 2 Captain Marvels team up, but she says, you know what? I've been toying with a name change more suited to my abilities, and that name is Photon. And we had covered another issue where she had changed, was debating the different names. I remember we had a lot of fun with it. But yeah, so this was 90s Avengers. Like, lots of action. I like these Captain Marvels. I don't know much about Jean as Vel, so I didn't get a lot of character out of him. Like, he was a little irritated with Star Fox, but some good fights. And a seriously jacked Star Fox and Vision. Yeah, so that's Avengers Unplugged on the Unlimited. What do you guys remember of this era? Yeah.
I think I have maybe one issue. I think Moonstone showed up once, but I followed, like, for the, like, the dollar book stuff, it was usually, like, Untold Tales of Spider-Man. But I think, if I'm not mistaken, if you bought it off the newsstand, I think you could get a double edition where it was, like, a flip book.
Oh, nice. That's kind of cool. Now, how, on your ranking of Avengers, where do you put, like, some of these, like, Vision and Deathcry and, you know, Kevin, was this, like, your lineup of Avengers, or?
No. My lineup is pretty classic. Vision's, like, one of the all-time Avengers, and Deathcry is one of the, like, if we were to do an episode or multiple episodes rating the Avengers, Deathcry would definitely go towards the bottom and Vision's towards the top.
I like that. Steve, any thoughts on this Avengers lineup?
Well, it's the Epting Palmer Bob Harris stuff, right? So yeah, I like that time for reading Avengers comics. Not the best lineup picking lineups, but as far as what the title was doing, you know, it's the Flak Jacket era with Crystal and the Black Knight kind of taking over the team, and it ends up being sort of a big long Black Knight character arc. I enjoy it.
Yeah, I liked how they managed to get a jacket look into Captain Marvel's. He's still wearing, like, an outfit, but they made, you know, they gave him a big collar and everything. I'm like, that's clever. That's commitment to this bit of everybody's got to have a jacket look. Even if you're not going to wear a jacket, we'll find something for you.
Kevin, I'm thinking we should make Andrew read the Peter David Captain Marvel series, though. That would be fun, right? That was a very... Yep. Steeped in the Marvel Universe history and lore type series.
You mean the first one?
Oh yeah, there was two, wasn't there? If you voted, you had to vote for it though.
Yeah, and it won.
Remember in Secret Wars time, they chose to name a bunch of the side titles the names of old Marvel properties, like Weird World and stuff, and it seemed like it was maybe to kind of make sure that that copyright gets renewed on, you know, on their title. I think lately, either in honor of Marvel's 100th anniversary or as a way to, like I'm suggesting, renew the copyrights, that Marvel's been revisiting, you know, past publishing events, sometimes in title only where the story has nothing to do with the original thing. But like they did the Atlantis attacks, they did the Absolute Carnage thing that was like Maximum Carnage. They had their Acts of Vengeance callback in the annuals. And now, and Andrew, you know how I love Cosmic, they did the Annihilation Scourge mini event here that was 5 issues long. Annihilation Scourge Alpha and Omega were one-shots written by Matthew Rosenberg, with art by Juanan Ramirez and Kyan Tormey and Manuel Garcia, and then 3 one-shots in between those bookends, each by different creative teams. There was Annihilation Scourge Beta Ray Bill, written by Michael Mordecai and art by Alberto Albuquerque. Annihilation Scourge Nova, written by Matthew Rosenberg with art by Ibram Roberson. And Annihilation Scourge Silver Surfer, written by Dan Abnett with art by Paul Davidson. So the idea here, guys, is it's kind of playing upon and developing the legacy and the fallout from both the Annihilation events in a callback to that, but also, Kevin, the Thanos imperative. The deal here is that the Cancerverse, where Nova and Star-Lord were trapped with Thanos for a while there, this Cancerverse has breached Annihilus's negative zone and is intent on conquering it. So Annihilus is trying to protect his realm, but eventually he's got to seek out help from once enemies Nova and the Fantastic Four. I mean, they were.
That's decent, but it's like, why do they keep on bringing back like the one of my lesser favorite ideas from that era?
Right. They have to fight the Revengers too, the Cancerverse version of the Avengers and everything.
Yeah.
But there are some kind of funny, like, buddy movie moments between Nova and Annihilus. At one point, they're shipwrecked, trapped, stranded on a planet from... They can't get to, like, the main fight, and reminded me of, like, the old 80s Battlestar Galactica when Starbuck was trapped on the planet with the Cylon and had to survive. Yeah. But there was some alright moments there, and along the way you get updates on, you know, Beta Ray Bill, who's still traveling around with Lockjaw, the Inhumans teleporting hound dog. And the Silver Surfer is still looking like he did at the end of Silver Surfer Black.
I've noticed that. Where else did he show up where he was looking like that? And then they're like, what do they call you? The Silver Surfer.
This gets right into that he's still feeling the effects and all that. It's pretty interesting. So, right, so that doesn't sound too bad, right? But what I didn't mention is that the whole series revolves around the Sentry and the Void. Oh. So tired of that, Andrew. So
I don't
tired.
Blame you. I think it... Last popped up in what, Doctor Strange for me or something?
That was good.
And then, you know, sort of spoiler, although it becomes pretty obvious as the story is developing along, they telegraph it that Nova has to sacrifice himself to the Cancerverse again, you know, to consume it and then be destroyed along with it, right? And he just finally shook the whole being tainted by the Cancerverse thing and everything, and now he's dead. Or is he, right? So,
well, yeah, because then the Guardians of the Galaxy series where he's showing up came after, so that's the thing, right?
Yep, you have to read to find out what happens, because it's...
I know, but it's like, the funny thing is, like, if you don't read this, and you just read the latest Guardians series... And he's like, oh, can't shake that the Cancerverse and all that. You'll just think he's having a relapse from the original story, not from this story.
I'm fine with that. I don't mind these mini events, but I really don't like this new, like, we're going to have this series that's all number ones or all alphas and omegas and yes. What, like... Just have, like, a four issue, even if you want different creative teams. They did that with that Defenders one, where it was all number one, so they could have them all, and then one that tied it together. And they were fine issues. It was just kind of, I don't know, irritating and made me pay more attention than I want to. I just want to go buy the comics.
That's the thing with Andrew. You got to make it easy. He doesn't want to be irritated.
Yeah, I just want to buy the comic. And buy the next one that goes with it. Not out, like, what Alpha, Omega, what, we're giving up on numbers now?
Now?
Is it Alpha,
Beta? This is a 90s thing.
Delta, Gamma? Is it Gamma? Which one? Is that the Hulk tie-in, the Gamma one?
Do you remember the Age of Apocalypse?
I only read that on the Unlimited as a whole event, and they just tell you what one to read next. I think we talked about that because you did not approve of their reading order, as always.
See, they had Alpha, Omega, and then when they were trying to reestablish the X-Men status quo in the universe, then they had a Prime issue as well.
That always messes things up. Where's the Prime one fit in?
Yeah, where's the point? Are we going back to the point system, Steve?
Oh, I hope we... I run across things now, and I'm always like... Oh, yeah, there was a point issue. Totally forget that every single time, or if I'm trying to rebuy something, I always forget that point issue is in there. And really, does it really... And 99% of those point issues, it doesn't really matter anyways.
I mean, sometimes they'd have those half issues or whatever that were annoying. But point, hey, that way you get like 9 issues between 1 and 2. Or...
Oh, jeez.
What really struck me after reading the New Warriors Sphinx tale last time around, and then this Nova-related story, is it makes me want to go back and read the old original Nova series from my youth, the Marv Wolfman stuff. You guys join me on that? Maybe next time we could do Nova.
That sounds super, Steve.
You sound very cosmic of you.
All right. I've got Gary waiting to come on to talk about the first bunch of post-John Byrne Alpha Flight issues, which I never read back in the day, so... This was a good Neither opportunity.
I didn't know the title continued. I thought they just went out.
Hey, Gary, welcome back to the bunker. It's been way too long.
Yeah, finally.
Far, far too long. Face front, true believers, it's always the guest's choice here on Marvel Noise. So... Gary, when I asked you, I mean, gosh, this is must be going on 18 months to 2 years ago now, what you wanted to talk about on Marvel Noise, like, give me something to read. What should we talk about? You mentioned the Alpha Flight run that Bill Mantlo wrote, where the creative teams of the Hulk and... Alpha Flight switched in the mid-80s.
Right.
This is Alpha Flight right after John Byrne's time. Alpha Flight issues 29 to 50, which ran from the fall of 1985 to the summer of 1987. And this really intrigued me when you mentioned it, and I readily accepted the... mission, not knowing that we wouldn't get to talk about it until now and get it on the air, but because I heard about this coming when I was a reader at the time. I was 15 in the summer of 85, but also the summer of 85 is right when I jumped out of comics for like 5 years.
Oh, geez.
It was like just before the switch happened, so I never read these books.
Well, the 80s was Well, like the early 80s was when I was working in New York City, still living with my mother, and I had plenty of extra money. So even though I would go out with my girlfriends on a weekend, I would go to the comic shops whenever I had a chance, and I would be buying up Marvel, DC, and then we'd go to one bookstore where I could get the independents. So I had probably too much extra money at that time.
Well, I mean, now it seems like, wow, big spender. But comics were not expensive back then, Gary. Even just your allowance, you could pick up all the new books for $3 or $4. You could get a lot of comics.
Yeah, the issues I'm looking at. 65 cents, and then it gets to 75 cents, and you know, and I remember at one time my girlfriend came over and she looked at me having piles of comics in my room, and she's like, what are you spending all your money on? That's probably when she was 2 years older than me, and she had a brother she had one brother that was married and had a child, and then she had another brother that was engaged. So she was like, she kept on like every once in a while saying, oh, my clock is ticking, my clock is ticking.
Oh, no. That sounds like a time bomb ready to go off.
And I was in my 20s, so I didn't have any clock that was ticking.
Do you cut the red wire or the blue wire, Gary? The clock is ticking. But, you know, that time, that 1985, I mean, the sweet spot, you know, my sweet spot was the late 70s through the early 80s there. But by that time, by 85, I mean, on the Fantastic Four, Byrne was doing his weird Zipitone stuff, and like right. he gave Sue the butch cut because he didn't want to have to draw her hair, and he was Al Gordon would soon be inking, so he was definitely cutting his corners on the art stuff there. On Thor, Simonson was still writing, but he wasn't drawing the book any longer. In Iron Man, they were, you know, Rhodey was Iron Man, but it was running its course, and it was about to end with issue 200.
Okay. And
in Captain America, issue 300 was kind of like Zek was now off the book, and so was J.M. DeMatteis with 300, even like because of the editorial intervention, 300 didn't come out like it was supposed to be and wasn't even a double-sized issue or anything, and it was kind of like a whimper. And
is that when he was the captain?
No, that would be way later in Gruenwald's
okay.
run.
Okay.
And then Moon Knight, the Doug Munch, Sienkiewicz Moon Knight book was canceled. Frank Miller and Klaus Janson were both off of Daredevil. The Micronauts were in their new Voyages, which, you know, were trash. Yeah. And Rom had left Earth, and they defeated all the Dire Wraths, and now he was like a cosmic book with the Ditko pencils. Uncanny X-Men was on its kind of weird march to 200, where like it was a lot of side stories, and a lot. I felt like the book was really meandering. Yep. After
there was a time when I would buy X-Men and not read it because I missed like one or two issues. And back then, if you missed two issues of X-Men, you could actually get lost.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like I got lost when they went to Australia.
Yeah, right, right. This is even before that.
I never was able to figure out what was going on after that.
And Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man, had been a favorite book of mine, but the Owl Doc Ock war was over when all the Black Cat romance stuff was over and everything. And Secret Wars 2 was happening like 6 months after Secret Wars ended, and it was terrible. And on the other side of town, they were doing Crisis, which to me felt like DC just trying to Marvelize their line by taking like the two Marvel creators that had hit it big over there with Wolfman and Perez, and they were just trying to Marvelize their books and take what was unique and fun about DC's history out of it. And I was like, you know what? I'm out of here. And the two books here in question, the Hulk was off world. He had been banished and he was on the interdimensional crossroads and stuff. And then Alpha Flight with Byrne on it, it was like, it too was kind of, there was no real direction to the series, and everything was a, like stories about just a couple of the characters, and not really like it wasn't a team book, really.
Well, maybe that's why Byrne switched with, switched with him because they maybe they he Byrne said, "Oh, I'm tired of doing this," and it was funny because like I remember when the first issue came out of Alpha Flight. And I went to a small con. I forget where it was. Maybe it was just in New Jersey, or maybe it was in New York. It was a small one-day con I went to, and Byrne was there. And I had my issue number one, and I had him sign it. And he looked at me, and then he said, "I want $5 for this." And I was like, "Huh? What?" And he goes, "Lots of times guys ask me to sign number ones and then they flip it." And I was like,
even back then,
there was no eBay.
Wow.
And I had no way of selling my comics back then, except for if I go to a hotel con and put up a couple boxes and selling them. And I wasn't really doing that at that time, doing the early 80s.
That's funny.
So I said, "All right, $5. And he made up some, I think he was giving it to some charity. Maybe Hero Initiative was that, you know, just getting started at that time. I don't know. But I was really surprised at that time that he asked me for $5.
Hilarious. I really thought of Alpha Flight at the time kind of like I've always felt about the Inhumans. I really liked the character designs. I really liked when they showed up in a book. It always meant something interesting was going to happen. but on their own, I don't know that I've really totally dug reading stories about them on their own and having to have their characters put through character growth. You know, maybe that's
it. I had certain favorites that I liked. I liked the one girl that they turned into a monster. Because I guess she was connected to some mariner in some way.
Marina, right.
Yeah, and I was kind of upset when they turned her into a monster. But then they occasionally, I think they changed her back.
Well, yeah, well, so let's get into it. Alpha Flight at this time is, it's Puck. He's the little, like, Tasmanian devil equivalent. And there's Heather, who is still grieving over the loss of her husband, who was the leader of the team.
Right.
There's Aurora and North Star, the twins who can fly and are like speedsters.
Yep.
There's Shaman, who is... he's a shaman. And there is also Box, who is a amputee who can phase himself into a large robot body that he does battle in.
Yes.
And also Snowbird, who can change into different Arctic beasts, but she's really unpredictable and she's kind of often AWOL.
Yeah, there's some of the stories in this run about her are really kind of weird.
Yep.
And you wonder what the writer was trying to say about certain things.
And the other important character is a supporting character who helps out, like, back at the headquarters, and that is Madison Jeffries, and he has the ability to transmute metal and mechanics into different shapes and things, which is useful task. And the creative team is writer Bill Mantlo, artist Mike Mignola, at least for a few issues, inker, heavy-handed inker Jerry Talloch. And this was the Hulk team, now switched over to Alpha Flight with issue 29.
Yeah.
So in issue 29, Alpha Flight's looking for a body to host the soul of Sasquatch, who has been slain. And they're, like, looking across the dimensional rift for a body. And they end up retrieving a body, but it's the Hulk. And he's there because he was banished by Doctor Strange and Incredible Hulk 300 to the interdimensional crossroads. So I'm like, oh, this is how he gets back. Because I never... knew how the Hulk got back from the crossroads, and he'd been there for almost a year. And man, Gary, the Hulk just tears through Alpha Flight and just takes off, like, heading home.
Well, the fun thing is when I remember when I read this about almost a year or 2 years ago, and I hadn't read it since I picked it up when I was, you know, in my 20s, I was saying to myself, that's basically inconsiderate of Alpha Flight to say, oh, maybe we could use the Hulk as a mindless body and put the spirit of Sasquatch into it.
Yeah.
In other words, they didn't know that Bruce Banner was a person and he was the Hulk.
Plus, what could go wrong, right? And then Shaman, who's a pretty powerful member of the team, he's having, like, a real issue with himself. He's lost his confidence. He's doubting his abilities because he lost his daughter. And, you know, like, he reaches into his pouch and his pouch is empty, Gary. He's got nothing. The team confronts the Hulk again in Vancouver, and with Snowbird's help, they actually survive. I mean, it's not like they win. They basically survive him as he moves back. And once he crosses the border back to the United States, they're like, all right, that's not our jurisdiction anymore. Later.
Now, when I was looking at the artwork for Manoa, I kind of thought that he was not what he is now. Do you know what I'm saying?
Of course. I mean, the covers are a closer representation of what his art style was at the time, but he was not a fast artist to be doing interiors. They matched him up with the heavy-handed inker and Talloch, and so I think we see a lot of Talloch and not a lot of Mignola Although, again, the colors give you a little bit more of that funny way that he liked to spot blacks at the time. But Mignola was more of a Joe Quesada. Like, they had a very similar style at the time from what I remember in my, boxing creative personnel into the little groups.
Because when I look at the way he drew the Hulk's face, and then a lot of the other faces, it didn't look right to me. And then Tarek, I'm familiar with because I think he used to work for DC, and I think he used to do like a lot of the horror and mystery mags over right. in DC.
Yeah.
So I kind of recognize his artwork. But I recognize his inking.
Well,
his inking was fine for that type of a story.
He had been really heavy over Sal Buscema on the Hulk on that run up to 200, and then once they were in the Crossroads, it switched over to the Mignola art on that book, which then brought him over to this book. But right. I don't think he liked it much because he didn't last too long.
And the covers, Manola's covers are great, you know, and those are the similar covers to what you would see on the classic X-Men, which was basically a reprint mag.
Right.
You would have a backup story, which was like 5 or 6 pages.
Yeah. I forgot that he did some of the stories on those and the covers.
Well, I don't know if he did the interior art, but I know he did the covers.
The issue ends 29 with Department H contacting Alpha Flight in the aftermath of the Hulk's rampage and grants them Avengers-like status in Canada. So now Mantlo's setting up this new status quo for the team. Issue number 30 has Alpha Flight getting established and moved into their new headquarters, which is in and under a 19th century mansion, and they even give us a full page with schematics and floor plans, which I love,
Gary. Yeah, I remember that diagram, and I thought,
Kevin
loves like the diagram.
Absolutely. Issue 31 has Shaman on a quest for, like, getting his mojo, basically. And, you know, of course it turns out the magic was never in the pouch, but it was in him all along and all that. And also the Caped Nemesis, whose design I always thought was cool, with her super sharp swords returns, this time to help Alpha Flight, and in the climax, there's a pretty cool scene where Puck uses Nemesis's sword to chop up the bad guy.
And this is when he sort of like starts getting a little defensive because he feels like there's a dark side of himself that he doesn't want the other members to find out.
So Mignola would stay on covers, but that's it. 3 issues for Mignola, and now we get John Bogdanov for guest penciling issue 32. And in this issue, Madison Jeffries and Box have created a Vindicator battle suit, just like Mac, the team leader, used to wear before he died, and now they've built one for Heather to wear.
And she was very reluctant to put it on at first.
And in training with Puck has a moment because he's been having these episodes of horrible pain, like musculoskeletal pain. And he's like, not now, not now, you know? And it turns out Puck is housing an ancient evil being called Razor who wants out. And when he comes out, he's like a giant smoky, like Arabian blade wielding demon who comes at a Puck, and Puck turns out he's really 6 feet tall and 70 years old.
Yeah, I'm looking at that page when the Razor character comes out of him, and it's definitely some like dark thing that never was in Arabian Nights.
And they give you the whole history of what happened with Puck and everything, and he tried to steal the Blade of Baghdad in 1939, and instead he was cursed to be a dwarf and to internally house this Arabian Razor demon like I can't even say it, Gary. It's just too crazy.
Well, they kind of show Puckus as a full, as like a very, you know, sizable individual, and then I guess later on at the end of the story he shrinks back. Or at the end of the plot line.
Well, of course, because that's the only way to defeat the Arabic demon, right? He has to suck it up and you know, internalize the demon again and accept his curse and owe the tragedy. Why couldn't Puck just be Puck? He was cool as Puck.
Well.
Anyway. Sal Buscema guest pencils for issues 33 and 34, where we get to check in on your favorite, but the still monstrous AWOL Marina, who is diving deep with the Submariner villain Atuma pursuing her. He wants to capture her in a net, which he does, and then use her as Namor bait.
Now, 33 and 35 I had to read as in digital because those two issues I was missing. And most of this is not on Marvel Unlimited, unfortunately, for the fans.
Yeah. Eventually, I'm sure it will be. Just not yet. Also in these issues, Snowbird is all like, I don't know, she's getting like dark Snowbird. She's getting fangs and her eyes are getting all red and evil looking and stuff. And she keeps asking for Shaman. Also, Heather seeks out Wolverine.
Right.
To help, like, train her because she needs to use the Guardian suit. And I guess he and Mac used to train back in the day and all that stuff.
Now this is it seems like when I was reading this, it kind of remembered, well, kind of reminded me of how Wolverine was very early on when they were first, like, of course he was, when they created him, he was a character with not much of a background. And then they had to create the background as they went along. Okay. And it's funny because, like, later on, I think Heather almost begins to think that her husband put the metal into Logan. And I don't know if that was how Marvel wanted it to be at one time, and then later on changed it and created the Weapon X lab.
Right. Right. I mean, it's because she at least alludes to the fact that he was complacent to knowing that it happened, right? I mean, because he worked for Department H and everything, and we know Department H gave him the skeleton, but no more than that. So we don't know if it was a good thing or a bad, you know what I mean? There was no value put on it yet. It wasn't described as a horrible thing.
So it almost made it look like her husband was a bad guy putting this metal inside of this person who was running around in the woods.
He was a government man, that's for sure. What's interesting, though, is that they get to have a fight together in the woods when they're off having their talk. And they fight Lady Deathstrike and her minions in the woods. And
right.
It's actually Lady Deathstrike's first encounter with Wolverine. And, you know, she would become a regular thorn, pun intended, in Wolverine's side for years. And right from the beginning, she's got the motive of she wants his bones. She wants the adamantium. And we get her whole origin and the reason why she's hunting for the adamantium and everything. And it's right here in Alpha Flight 33 and 34. Who knew?
So is this really her first appearance? Or was she somebody else's villain before this?
Didn't she come across Wolverine in Japan with the Mariko stuff?
Okay.
She was Lady Deathstrike? But this is her first Lady Deathstrike showing up and meeting Wolverine for the first time.
All right, so she was in that the four-issue miniseries?
I don't remember.
Okay.
I can't remember. I forget. Because I wasn't around for this whole... By the time I got back into comics, Lady Deathstrike was already well established.
I guess I should have refreshed. I recently got a big, like, 5-short box collection from somebody at work. And they asked me to sell it for them. Mm. And one of those things that went very fast was the 4-issue Wolverine miniseries.
Sure.
And I should have like taken some time out to refresh my memory and read that.
Yeah, that had that Yukio character. And yeah, you know, I always get them mixed up, the Mariko and Yukio and all these. What's interesting about Wolverine and the depiction here, like you said, it reminds you of how Wolverine used to be depicted. He's absolutely brutal against these very human samurai garbed thugs of Lady Deathstrike. I mean, they show him ripping into guys' guts and then like sneaking up on guys from behind and slicing them from behind, like their necks from behind and stuff. It's brutal.
Well, that's how he was in the beginning. Yes. You remember that old
I do.
It's him against everybody in the night and Helm Fire Club.
Sure, sure. So. Issue 35 introduces the new penciler for the book, Dave Ross, whose work I would later come to be very fond of when he would follow Byrne and Paul Ryan on West Coast Avengers.
Okay.
In issue 35, we've got Marina being imprisoned by Atuma, and Snowbird, she's like possessed. She's barely able to be contained. She's got to see Shaman. And the bulk of this issue is Shaman's vision quest to regain his mystical confidence, which he does, and he gets a makeover in the process. Issue 36 has Shaman rejoining Alpha Flight just in time to inform them that Snowbird is about to give birth. That's what's going on. She's been in labor.
This is the start of a weird
I know.
Storyline.
I know. That's like Carol Danvers' Avengers 200 weird. The Atlantean character Byra reaches Namor, who was with the Avengers at this time.
Okay.
Tells him of Atuma's plans and plots and machinations and stuff. And Doctor Strange gets called in by Shaman to help them find a place of power for the big birth event. In issues 37 and 38, Shaman's daughter Talisman returns to help, and the birth takes place, but it goes sideways pretty quick, Gary. There's like tentacles and maggots, and this being called Pestilence comes forth and fights everyone.
Well, that's what I was saying before. You wonder what the writer was trying to say about childbirth in this story.
I take it you've been in the operating room too.
No, I haven't. That's the funny thing. I mean, maybe he had like a bad experience of a baby who was crying all the time or something.
But funny. In the end, the pestilence being steals Snowbird's infant baby son. Meanwhile, Namor makes his assault on Atuma to free Marina. And Byra shows up looking for Alpha Flight as reinforcements to help out. Because, heck, they were former teammates of Marina's, right? They should want to help.
Right.
Issues 39 and 40 are part of a crossover with Avengers 272. And these issues are penciled by Dave Ross and new inker Wils Portacio. Alpha Flight is teaming up with the Avengers, with Namor, to free Marina. And then Marina goes on the run, and she's, like, further mutating, and it gets pretty gnarly and nasty, and then they encounter this big bio blob who's supposed to be her mate. And,
yeah, that's weird. Man,
it was hard to follow. In the end, though, somehow, when the bubbles clear from the depths, Marina accepts Namor as her mate, and, like, they have a wedding.
Well, that was the other thing that I remember when I was reading this mag, and I think I might have been reading some fanzines and other things. There would be people claiming, oh, you know, she's too young to be with Namor. He's from World War II. You know, and I'd be in my cap, and I was like, I like Marina, but the thing is like, it's just a character. So how can you start to impose, you know, saying, oh, she's the child and he's like a 50-year-old and you can't really start like evaluating that way. Now 40 has like the cover where you have a portrait, and then you have a lot of the Marvel characters around it.
Yeah, the anniversary issue.
Yeah. Now, I have like sort of a side business where I sell back issues, and sometimes the comics from this month, people come and people, you know, ask me to, you know, to buy up certain issues, and then I'll collect them, and then I'll be wondering, you know, what's the thing in common, and then I'll look at all the covers, and I realize that they were scalping out the these issues.
That's funny.
Because they want to get all of them. And just the other day, I found the Transformer issue number 22, which has the same type of cover, which is a portrait and then the Marvel characters around it.
Nice.
And it's kind of funny because that was a licensed comic, and you wouldn't think that they would do that because, well, I guess the Transformers was part of the Marvel Universe at that time.
Well, wasn't that the coolest thing about Marvel's handling of licensed properties back then? I mean, right from the end of the 70s, they did it with the Micronauts. They did it with the Shogun Warriors. They did it with Godzilla. For gosh sakes, it was a S.H.I.E.L.D. book, right? With Dum Dum Dugan following Godzilla around.
Yeah, and they had that character Red Ronin or something like that.
Sure. And they had, what else? The G.I. Joe, maybe not so much, but Spider-Man crossed over with Transformers.
Yeah, I guess it depended on that. I guess it depended on the contract and the rules, and that maybe they would say, oh, you could put S.H.I.E.L.D. in, but you couldn't put, you know, too many characters because, and now they can't even reprint any of those magazines because.
ROM, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, they made a lot of the creative, you know, world building around those, a lot of those properties too, right? I mean, we know that the guys from Marvel, Bob Budiansky and company, created the whole, what the deal was with the Transformers and who they were and all that, what their motives were and all that. And the same thing for the ROM stuff and the Micronauts. And because we've seen when other companies years later have access to the properties, they don't have access to the stuff that Marvel created. And, you know, exactly. The comics are just a shell of what we remembered and were fond of because it's not what it used to be.
Yeah, even G.I. Joe, I was listening to somebody who knew the background of G.I. Joe from when it was the big figure, and he was saying that before Marvel got a hold of the license for G.I. Joe, there was no Cobra.
Right.
And it was more like, at first, they wanted it to be one person who would put on different types of equipment and have battles, and then Marvel said, no, that's not going to work. And they turned it into the team book that it became and added Cobra.
Sold a lot of toys that way.
So it never would have become what it is now without the Marvel writers.
All right, back to Alpha Flight. Issues 41 and 42 have the team officially voting Madison Jeffries onto the squad. And I mean, he was playing a pretty major supporting role. And North Star runs into the teenage daughter of the Purple Man at a ski competition. And this is, I find Purple Man stories often intriguing, Gary, and this one's no different. She makes North Star her boyfriend, but while swimming together in their Garden of Eden, where she has him take her, he learns that when he's submerged in the water, she can't control him.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, though, she does get the upper hand on him and makes him bring her to Alpha Flight, saying she wants to join them, which this is some audition, right?
Yeah, well, the funny thing is like when I was reading this to refresh my memory, I did not remember that she was in Alpha Flight. I kind of remember her from when she didn't she join like X Factor or X-Men Legacy later on?
Maybe. I don't remember.
At some time, she joined one of the other X-Men teams.
She makes a hasty escape from the Alpha Flight after her request to join the team doesn't go over very good. And she uses Madison Jeffries to help her with the getaway. And they get caught up with this whole character, the auctioneer, who tries to sell them to the highest bidder and all this. And She eventually tells the auctioneer to drop dead, and he does. Oof.
Yeah, I remember seeing that sign, and I was like, okay, they really, because she is as powerful as the Purple Man.
After that, Heather thinks, actually, she'll make a great Alpha. Well, make that Beta Flight team member. And so here she is, Kara Kilgrave, the Purple Girl. I wonder if Kevin knows about this tale, because he also likes Purple Man stories, along with me. Issue 43 has another mind control aspect to it, with Mesmero escaping and fleeing to Canada with a squad of Sentinels after him. So we get to see Alpha Flight fighting Sentinels, who's trying to get to Mesmero.
I was just reading a recent couple of stories of Mesmero in there. They might have been back issues, but they were like X-Men against the Mesmero.
Sure. There's a cool scene here where Mesmero is sending enthralled people at Kara Kilgrave, but she commands them back at him, and Mesmero's all, no one's ever had the power to override me before, and she's like, I do. It's pretty cool. Also, Box is sent off for diagnostics to this healer guy who is Madison Jeffries' brother. Madison Jeffries can transmute mechanics, and his brother can transmute, like, biology.
Yeah, that guy is also a very unusual character. He's like, later on, Box tries to think that he could create a body for him.
Well, he wants legs because he's got a thing for Aurora.
Yeah.
Issues 44 and 45 have Shaman and Snowbird coming and letting everyone know that they've located the evil Pestilence, who still has Snowbird's son. And so they rally the troops and battle Pestilence in these subterranean Arctic caverns. This is brutal, Gary, because Pestilence has the baby, and he can control Snowbird, who's taken on the Sasquatch form.
Yep. Because you have the big, you have the covers where they have the big Sasquatch attacking all the members.
And Pestilence is like, he's a loose consciousness that needs to inhabit other vessels and bodies. He forces Snowbird to kill her own baby with him inside it, so that he's then free, and then Vindicator is trying to stop her from killing the baby, and so then she blasts Snowbird in her Sasquatch form, killing her. Oh, it's the body count. I mean, they quite literally bring back body bags from this adventure. Alpha Flight goes home to lick their wounds, do you call this a happy ending, Gary? I mean, Shaman helps Snowbird's spirit find her child's spirit, and, like, they cross over together. But, you know.
Like I said, I didn't understand. Whenever they had the baby, I could not understand what the writer was trying to say about. Like I said, maybe he had a bad experience with some baby that was crying too much.
But Box returns, and he's got legs now and no gut, and Aurora is delighted. Then Snowbird's buried Sasquatch form, because that's how she was killed, rises from the grave and attacks, possessed by Pestilence, right? He needs a body to house, so when he came out of the baby, he went into the... It was all part of the plan.
Yeah, he comes out at night, and you see him, like, rising from the grave. And now, what is this guy? Now, there's also this guy with this big helmet.
Yeah, he was a minor thing. It was a little weird side thing of their little Ant-Man equivalent from the old Beta Flight. But you'll have to read the issues to get the full scoop. We can't page by page it.
Right. I'm just thumbing through as I refresh my memory.
Box's armor fights the Sasquatch, possessed Sasquatch off, but it's not Box in the driver's seat. of Box's armor, it's the disembodied Walter Lungowski. It's the Sasquatch consciousness.
And I think they don't know it until the end of the end of that issue.
In the end, Pestilence gets trapped in Shaman's medicine bag, and Walter Lungowski's spirit consciousness ends up in the Snowbird Sasquatch's body. I mean, ba-dum-bump, right? Sasquatch is back. What a weird way. And Aurora is thrilled. Again. Well, Box isn't. He's bummed. Well, here's the weird thing, though. Oh, my gosh, Gary. Sasquatch changes back to human form, and he's not Walter now. He's like this hot, white-haired chick.
I know. I'm looking at the last page, and Marvel was like sort of ahead of its time with having, you know, two gay characters, so to speak, but they weren't really gay.
In issue 46, we have June Brigman coming in as to provide pencils with inker Wills Portacio. And Aurora is horrified by this turn of events now after being thrilled so often and just flies off, freaking out. And both Box and Sasquatch are vying for her attention. And she's never been the most emotionally stable person to begin with, you know?
Well, she was sort of like she had multiple personalities, as I recall.
Just two.
Okay, two's enough, I guess. Where sometimes she'd be very introverted and prudish, and then other times she would be very flirtatious with men.
And she's been in the flirtatious mode for many, many issues now. Locked the introverted Jeannie Marie personality away. But in this issue, in issue 46, Box snaps from the rejection, and he armors up and he attacks Aurora. And the rest of the team intervenes and all that, but the shock has turned Aurora back into the introverted Jeannie Marie. Box fights the team, but Madison Jeffries in the finale, pulling his finishing move, phases into the suit, driving Box out. And Box is all like, "That's what you wanted all along, isn't it? You've always been against me." Issue 47 is a real collaboration effort art-wise. It's pencilers Craig Braisfield, Mike Mignola, and Steve Purcell, and inkers Will Sportacio and Terry Austin. And this one's a Vindicator solo tale where Heather returns home and has a big talk with her folks and then ends up fighting a bunch of Ents from outer space.
She's really becoming, you know, like comfortable with that suit. And comfortable with her, the abilities of that suit, to the point where she doesn't, you know, where before she didn't want to put it on, and now she's like accepting it full blown.
Issues 48 and 49 are penciled by Terry Shoemaker and June Brigman, respectively. And Alpha Flight is bringing Box to their healer, Madison Jeffries' brother, and it doesn't go well. He malignantly transmutes Madison Jeffries and others and himself, and he ends up being like a bioweapon, kind of like The Thing, like the John Carpenter movie one, not Aunt Petunia's favorite nephew.
You had me going then, Steve.
Madison Jeffries ends up turning the tide of the battle when he transmutes the Box armor into a new design with new capabilities. And it's so funny when the big homunculus is defeated, he's like a pile of bioorganic tissue with a face he's like soap boxing and like still like pontificating at our heroes, and then the purple girl just tells him to shut up.
And now I'm looking at the cover, and it is kind of a weird character design. It's just sort of like a blobby type of a giant.
Issue 50 is the double-sized anniversary issue in the summer of 1987. Pencils by June Brigman, inks by Will Sportacio. North Star has been becoming, like, progressively more ill. He was infected by the Pestilence character some time ago, and he's hocking up a lung.
He keeps on coughing, and then at this point, I almost am wondering if this is the start of the change in the character, because he later on admits that he's gay.
Yeah, but that's like 10 years later.
Well, okay. Maybe I'm mixing it too much, but maybe I thought, okay, this is when they start to change him, and maybe they would try to, like, use him less because they wanted to change the character.
Well, yeah, you're right. I'm unnecessarily de-emphasizing what you're saying, because you're right. This is Mantlo wanting to do something with the character.
Right.
Whether you like it or don't like it, it's changing. You know, Byrne carried on from how the character was initially presented and kind of gave us more of that. And here we're getting some character development or growth, if you want. And we'll get more into the specifics of it in a couple minutes. But it wasn't until after issue 100 that the big homosexuality reveal happened, and this is issue 50, so I mean, you know, it's more like five years later.
Fast forwarding too fast, you know, because I didn't remember what issue when he came out of the closet.
But knowing that in hindsight, when you go back and read these stories, doesn't it seem like it informs the story in a different way? Because I certainly felt that when I was reading them.
Yeah, and
the whole thing of the purple girl making him her boyfriend and everything took on a different twist reading it, knowing that 50 issues later he'd come out of the closet, you know?
Well, that's the kind of thing that I guess I was looking for hints of that when I was reading these old issues, because I was saying to myself, gee, when I remember the first 20 issues when Byrne was there, he was sort of like, they always portrayed him as a ladies' man. And then later on, they made him switch. I was like looking for hints of the switch.
So North Star here, like we say, he's deteriorating. And Alpha Flight decides to search the caverns in the Arctic where they fought Pestilence for answers and maybe some magic and stuff. And that gets the attention of Loki, of all people.
Right.
And Alpha Flight is looking for, like, there's no magic left in this mountain, Gary. The fire pit, there's no fire in the pit, right? The lights are out. At the bottom of the pit, though, there's this big seal with these glyphs all over it and everything.
Yeah, that looks pretty ingenious.
So the team manages to get through and open it, and they find this dark cauldron instead of like the light flame that they were expecting to find. And Puck ends up in the darkness and he's cured. But in doing so, that releases the razor being, right? Oh, here we go again with the big razor. And North Star is having this fever dream about elves and that the runes on the gate seal, they're elven. And that his father found this place and discovered elves and fell in love with one and married one and had North Star and Aurora, and they're half elf.
You see these skinny women dancing around with very little clothing.
And then once North Star's awake, he explains all this to Aurora, who then depletes all of her elven light. Now we know that their light is elven in origin, into North Star to heal him, but now she's human and powerless. Loki also releases a bunch of armored dark elves for the team to fight, and Alpha's handling them, they're keeping up, but then that razor being shows up and starts swinging his sword around, and he's unstoppable.
I think they wanted to use him as the main villain for the book because he's obviously a better villain than those little elves.
Their only option is to run for it at this point. So they run out the hole, they clear the gate, and they close the seal, sealing Razor, trapping him by the elven magics, right? But Aurora and Puck aren't with them. They didn't make it. And North Star, in the aftermath, he decides to retire to the elven realm, and a little, like, gate opens up in the clouds, and the elves welcome him in and into the vault. It's kind of weird. And then there's a funny two end sequence where Loki is facing judgment, but he ends up challenging his accusers by explaining that he actually helped everyone, because North Star's healed and he went into the vault with the elves, and Aurora's mind is now whole, and he promises he teleported her out of there and she's okay. And Puck is cured and in Tibet and cured of the whole razor thing and everything. Man, Loki's just the best, right?
He always comes out shining. I don't understand.
Heather, though, she feels terrible, although she realizes that now all of the original members of Alpha Flight are gone. And whatever is left of the team and whatever goes forth after issue 50 is all her. And she's the leader, and she's shepherded this team through this transition, and, you know, she has earned it.
Well, she really becomes a strong female leader for this team. And I guess that's like her journey. And at that time, at the 80s, there was not too many teams that had strong female leaders. Maybe you had Captain Marvel over the Avengers, who was the leader for some time.
Right.
You had Storm, who was the leader of the X-Men for a while.
Yeah.
So Marvel, I guess, was putting women in charge of certain teams at that time.
It's amazing to think of, again, what was happening in, you know, with the title historically in Marvel's publishing timeline. You've got the big switch between Mantlo and Byrne, right? Byrne goes over right to do the Hulk, and Mantlo comes over with whatever story he's ready to tell here. And he really moves these characters to different places by the time after these 22 issues here and when we hit issue 50. Like, Heather, she's taken on her husband's legacy and is now wearing the suit and everything.
Right, right.
She's led the team through a complete roster turnover now. And Puck, we learned that he's actually 70 years old and 6 feet tall, and he was cursed to be a dwarf, and now he's cured and in Tibet. Snowbird got pregnant and gave birth to a son who then got kidnapped, who then she killed, and then she got killed. Sasquatch somehow ended up in Snowbird's dead body that looks just like his old Sasquatch body, so he's Sasquatch, but he's now a girl. North Star got sick, and then he got all of his sister's light, and it turns out he's half elf, and he went off to join the elves. Aurora did her personality switch thing and ended up totally depleting all of her power. Shaman leveled up and then left this plane of existence. Box went nutty over Aurora's rejection and ended up incarcerated after he attacked the team and everything. And Marina got married to Submariner. Like, maybe she ended up the best out of everybody.
Well, I don't know when her metamorphosis happens after this, but she doesn't have too nice of an ending either.
I tell you, though, what I really enjoyed about reading these issues, Gary, was just filling in this blank spot in my knowledge of the Marvel Universe's fictional history, you know? Like, I had heard of the kooky Puck's not a dwarf thing, but it's fun to see how Mantlo and company really deconstructed the group. You could almost call this whole run, like, the Alpha Flight disassembled, you know?
Well, it is kind of a shame that you had to stop buying comics in the 80s, you know, I guess the late 80s, because that was the peak time, I think, for a lot of the publishers. I stopped buying in the I guess, from like 93 on to like 98, because I was living in Connecticut at the time, and the two comic shops that I knew of were so far away from where I lived that I didn't really have time, lots of times, to go and pick up issues. And I was too busy working overtime. So I kind of dropped out in the 90s. And then later on, I found a new comic shop where I lived in Norwalk, and then I started going there on a weekly basis and buying stuff. But I was kind of like reading it very fast and not really digesting it and not really enjoying a lot of it. And at that time, I really didn't bag and board it either. It was just like disposable entertainment to me. I would just throw it in a box and leave it in my garage. And then later on, when I had to move out of that condo, I just took like two or three boxes of comics and brought them over to the comic shop that I bought them from. And I said, "You want these?" And he said, "You didn't even bag them?" And I said, "No." And he didn't even give me any money for them because they were all like, you know, like read through and just like, you know, yeah. Maybe like human
reader copies. As we
yeah,
call them.
So like, you know, and some of it might have been valuable if I had bothered to bagging, but because I just had some of the new, like when Alice Ross first did the Marvels, so I might have had those issues. So those might have been like worth something, but since I didn't bag and board them, they weren't worth anything.
Funny.
And I just wanted to, you know, get rid of those because I was moving back to New Jersey at the end of the time in 98. So
well, we both had our 5-year sabbaticals.
Yeah. And so, and now just November, I stopped pre-ordering from DCBS. Nothing against the distributor, but I got to the point where I had so many unread issues.
Yeah.
That I said to myself, I can't keep on buying and buying and buying.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And have all these comics that I haven't read. So I stopped last November, stopped buying.
There's too much out there to read it all. Yeah, looking at it in hindsight and picking and choosing the stuff that you really are interested in, there's something to be said for that approach.
Well, the thing is like when you pre-order, you order like what, 2-3 months in advance, and then when you get it, and nowadays the stories are 6 issues long or 5 issues long, and you don't know if you are enjoying the story until you're halfway through it.
You got to read it to know what's in it.
So some of the things. So like, I'm just going to read what I have for a long time. And then later on, when I run out of new comics that I haven't read, then I might start going, you know, through Marvel Unlimited, and then I might join the DC Universe and just do it digitally, you know. Because when we do move down to Florida, wherever we're going to be retiring to, I don't think my wife is going to let me have too many comic books in the community living space that we're going to get. You know what I mean?
You've earned it. You've earned your right for some space, though, Gary.
I think my space is going to be one short box, Steve.
Well, listen, man, thanks for coming back on the show. And now you're going to, we've been sitting on this one for so long. Now you're going to have to pick something else for us to read for next time. So thanks, Gary.
All right.
Until Subby's marriage with Marina ends happily ever after with a kiddo named, you guessed it, name Arena. Make mine Marvel. Later.
All right. Take care, Steve.
empire.